This is the second interview with Pat Hitchcock, who served with the Red Cross Recreation Division during World War II. We are conducting this interview at the Mount Horeb Public Library, and the date is Wednesday, October 29th, 2008. The interviewer is Jessica Williams. Okay. And I think we are going to pick up this time where you were telling me about getting ready to leave the Club Mobile.
Well, I had to apply to get into a different service, and I decided to go into hospital because I thought that would be a little more rewarding than just club. I mean, I felt that I wanted to be with the American soldiers that were still in Germany, if I could get to Germany. And did I talk about Germany?
Not very much. Oh.
And I wanted to be sure that I was doing something effective. And so I applied to hospital, and I got in, and I got a transfer up to Karlsruhe. First, we had to go to Wiesbaden to go through a week of orientation and training. And while I was there, did I talk about Richard Sherman? While I was there, I wanted especially to go into Germany also, because whenever I had some free time, I wanted to look up the man who started youth hostling, whose name was Richard Sherman. He was the founder and the person who was responsible for youth hostling getting in all the different countries of the world. And they didn't know what happened to him. They knew that he would not concur with Hitler to be the Hitler Youth person, commander. And so because of that, because of his refusal, and the reason they asked him was because he was so popular with young people, and he'd done so much to get young people after the First World War out into the country, out hiking and biking and going to different places where they could stay overnight for 25 cents a night. And they would have sleeping sacks, and they would take their own sleeping sacks, would just be a sheet sewed up, and then they would get a blanket at the youth hostel and a bed to stay. And it was a wonderful way of introducing young people to other people out of their own orbit, and they actually, it became a wonderful way to introduce people of different countries to each other, because there was always, later on, as soon as the hostels were established, you could go to Norway and visit the youth hostel there, and there would be hostlers from all over the world, and so on. That was the idea. And the also the idea was, because the German children after World War I were very weak, and they hadn't had the proper food and so on. And it was his way of getting them out into the outdoors and exercise and build up their strength again. And most countries, all countries, picked up on that. And it was in a way our Peace Corps. And I wanted to find Richard Sherman if I could.
Was he a German?
Pardon?
Was he German?
He was German.
Okay.
Yeah. And the first youth hostel was in Altona, Germany, which was right near his home. And it was a castle. And the young people would go there to, and that was a, and actually what happened was that there were two young men who were his godsons. were in hostling. Well, of course, they were very important in hostling over in Germany when they were in college age. And Monroe Smith, the American youth hostel, head of the American youth hostels, took the first group over there just before the war. Mm-hmm. And these two boys, Fritz and Karl Kaufold, who were Richard Sherman's godsons, they took Monroe and his group of college students climbing in the Italian Alps. And this is a little bit of a side, but it tells you how I was thinking in mm-hmm. those days. Mm-hmm. Because of that experience, I had a number of friends who were conscientious objectors when I went into hostling after the war, or actually I was in it before the war as mm-hmm. a youth hostler, and I had friends who were on the staff there who were conscientious objectors. And they just couldn't bring themselves to kill a German. Mm-hmm. And they'd had such a wonderful time, and they loved those two boys. And those two boys came over to help start youth hostling in the United States. Monroe brought them over, and they managed to escape being German soldiers. But then they were conscientious objectors, too. They had to be. So I guess they took out American citizenship. They must have, because they were COs, too. And so although I didn't think it was fair for the girls to say that they could be conscientious objectors, because at that time we weren't held accountable. We didn't have to go. Mm-hmm. The boys really had to put their life on the line and decide. Mm-hmm. But there was an inordinate number of them who came out of youth hostling who went into conscientious objector state. So when I got the first free day I got in Wiesbaden, I mean, there were free. We had a Saturday, I think it was. Mm-hmm. I went out on the trolley to go to a place where Richard had been. Mm-hmm. It was called Gravenwiesbach, and it was near Frankfurt. Well, I went to Frankfurt, and I got on a trolley, because there were no other transportation. And the trolley went as far as it could go, and I figured, well, in the right direction, and then I thought I would walk. Well, I had a uniform on, of course, mm-hmm. and I felt very uncomfortable because I remembered the story that the Belgian Red Cross woman was telling me when she gave me a ride from Paris to Brussels in her Red Cross truck. And she was a very interesting woman, actually. She invited me to stay in her home that night, and she was evidently a very wealthy woman, because she had a beautiful home, and she was a member of the Belgian Red Cross and was doing everything she could to help at that time. She was telling me about what it was like in the German occupation. And she was saying that they would get on the trolley and the Germans would get on. I mean, she would be saying the Germans would get on and people didn't like them at all because they were an occupying force. And she said when it was raining, they have their umbrellas. And she said when the trolley would stop, it would stop with a jerk, and they would jam their umbrellas down in the feet of the Germans, as though they were making trying to get their balance. And they all she also told me that they would ask the trolley conductor where the street was that they wanted to get off, and he would take them to the end of the line, and then he would say "Wer so go," which means "Will you be so good as to get off?" Or "Here is the place where you want." So, of course, I was thinking of these things while I was on this trolley, sitting down, surrounded by Germans, and feeling really uncomfortable and wondering how, knowing they were very unhappy with me there, although I wasn't, you know, I wasn't a soldier, but just the same, they didn't want Americans there. But they were very glad that Americans were there rather than Russians, or so they were fairly decent to us.
Right.
And well, they had to be anyway. So, so we got to the end of the line, and I got off, and I started walking. I had maps, and I knew that I might have about 4 miles to walk. And of course, you know, when you're way out like that, alone, it's not a comfortable feeling either, but especially in if you're an occupier in a country like that. But I walked along a short distance, and a Jeep came by and stopped, of course. He saw me in uniform. He said, "What?" It was a GI. "What are you doing out here?" You know. And I told him, I said, I'm trying to find a man who started an organization that I'm very close to in the United States, and it's called Youth Hostling, and I was explaining to him, and I try to find him, and I know his village where they might be able to tell me where he is, you know, or what happened to him. I also knew at the time that when he refused to join Hitler's organization, you know, and be the head of the youth movement, he was told that he would have to, instead of sending him to a concentration camp, which was very surprising, they told him, because they knew he was so popular, that he would have to disappear. They never wanted to hear about him again, or just go somewhere, but they didn't want him to write anything or be seen by anybody, or be known where it was that he was. So he took his family. Well, I'm getting ahead of my story. So the GI took me to the village, and I stopped and asked some people who were walking beside the road if they knew of Richard Sherman. They said, "Of course, we know Richard Sherman." And I said, "Does he live in town?" And he said, "Yes, he just lives up there. Huh. He was he's teaching in our grammar school." Huh. And the GI took me to the house. It was a nice little house on the side of a hill in the country. And he said, "I'm going to wait for you. Wait here, and you go and see what you can find there. And if you don't find them, I'll take you wherever else you want to go." So I went up and knocked on the door. And I heard the scurrying, but I couldn't see anybody. And then everything was very quiet, and I knocked again and again, and nobody came. So I finally said in my broken German, very broken, "Ich habe einen Brief from Monroe Smith." As soon as I said Monroe Smith, the place just came alive. There were six children, and the mother and the dad. And they just leapt up and came out and greeted me. And I couldn't believe that I was this fortunate to find him. And I had brought all of my rations, you know, every week. I think I said that every week we got rations. And so I had brought everything and was really happy that I had done that. But anyway, I motioned to the GI, "Okay, bye-bye, I'm fine, and you don't have to stay." And I didn't know how I was going to get back, but that didn't matter. So I found him in the first week I was in Germany. And ever after that, whenever I was close to Frankfurt, I would go up there and be with that family, take my rations, and enjoy their wonderful loving kindness and hospitality. And, you know, he told me a lot about the war, what it was like to be there, and how the Americans would strafe them when they were out in the fields, come over, fly over, and shoot, use them for target practice. Yeah, and of course he was, the reason they didn't come to the door was because I had on a uniform, mm-hmm. and they were terrified, you know. Mm-hmm. And I also heard that while he was in, during the war, he was in the North Sea swimming with his family, on having a picnic, and they tried to, two men came and tried to drown him. But he was a very strong man. He was, you know, he one of their, one of the things that they said in youth hosteling was strength through joy. Mm-hmm. And they didn't smoke or didn't drink, and they just believed in physical fitness, mm-hmm. very, very, very much. And so he was a very strong man, and although he hadn't had a lot of food, he still was able to get away from those men, mm-hmm. and so they didn't go out like that anymore. But anyway, the war was over, and he knew the war was over, and so he knew it wasn't as bad as it could have been if I had knocked on the door. I don't know what he expected, but he was scared. They all were. But I would take my rations, and I tried to. You know, we had a carton of cigarettes, and I tried to convince him to take the carton of cigarettes, and he absolutely refused, because of course in youth hosteling you don't smoke. And then after a while I was able to point out to him that this carton of cigarettes will feed your goat for 1 year. With you can buy hay with one carton of cigarettes, enough to feed your goat all year round. And I mean, in the winter. And so he did. He took it. But of course, he didn't take any of the cognac or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But they had butter and sugar and things that they just hadn't had for years, and they loved, and they were so happy. And they wanted me to stay and eat with them. And so I often did. And what I would have, what they would feed me, and this was. After the Japanese War was over, I mean, we were out of what this was right after, more or less. Everybody would have a plate about 10 inches across, heaped with potatoes, that the skins on them, of course, and that had been boiled. And I mean, I just couldn't believe they could eat all those potatoes, but they did. That's all they had. Mm-hmm. They ate them, and then they, in a couple of hours, the children were hungry. Potatoes, just potatoes, don't sustain you very well. Mm-hmm. Another thing they had to eat, which their mother fixed, mm-hmm. she'd go into the woods and get mushrooms and saute them down until they were kind of a spread, like a butter, mm-hmm. and put them, every family got one loaf of black bread a day, and they would have to go down and stand in line. She would have to go down and stand in line so that she could get it at the little store there. And that's all they got. And then she would slice it, of course, very thin. It was one of those square loaves, rather large, black bread, they called it, black German, and it was pumpernickel. Mm-hmm. And she would cut it very thin, mm-hmm. and spread some of this mushroom on it, mm-hmm. and make it, give two slices to her children who went to school, mm-hmm. and make it into a sandwich. And that's all they had for their lunch all day long, was that little sandwich with a mushroom in the middle. And the children, there would be, out of the six children, one child could go to school per day because they only had one pair of shoes. So, and they'd get on a train and they would go for a long distance to go to school. And they would come home and talk about how they had raided the garbage pans of the American Army and gotten food. So you can see how desperate they were. But anyway, I was happy that I, very happy that I could let people know that he was alive and well. And so that's what I would do sometimes with my time off. Well, I was stationed in Karlsruhe, which is has a very famous woods. And it had a good hospital, American hospital, that it was a German hospital before, and it was now American hospital. And the boys there were waiting to get well enough to go home. Mm-hmm. And some of them had been in the Battle of the Bulge. Mm-hmm. And so they were, really, some of them were pretty sick, and some of them were almost ready to leave. And I was with three other girls, and we had a club in the hospital, sort of, it was. I had a craft shop, mm-hmm. and I had all kinds of tools. And wood, I could get wood, whatever I wanted. And you know, we would go to certain places if we didn't have what we needed and appropriate them, which was not fair, I guess, but that's what we would do because that's what the service did. That's what Americans did. They just, if they needed a couch or something, they just go to where... Well, I'm not sure where they'd go, but they would go and get one somewhere mm-hmm. that the Germans had. And so we'll see. What else should I tell you about that particular moment? We had we would have parties for the men. We would have German girls. Not German girls, Polish girls who were displaced persons, they called them. Mm-hmm. And they had been captured, mm-hmm. and they'd been held in a camp for a long time. Mm-hmm. And they were still there because it takes a long time to get, you know, things turned around. Mm-hmm. And they were still in this camp, well-treated and fed, because that's what we were doing. The United States was doing that, the Americans were. And we were in the American zone. There were four zones, American, English, Russian, and, three zones. Okay. And we were in the American zone, of course. And people were very glad because we were very generous with the food and whatever we could get for them, we gave them. Mm-hmm. They weren't allowed to drive, of course. They had no way of driving. And so we would get freed. We would get R&R, which means rest and recreation. And we would be allowed to go somewhere. And so we took the Jeep, and two or three of us went often. And the reason I say often is because the situation was so confusing. And the American Army really wasn't prepared for the end of the war. They... didn't expect it, I guess, to come so soon. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, we had the nuclear bomb, so that ended very quickly. Mm-hmm. And so they weren't really ready to take care of the situation without fighting. they didn't have a very good military government set up, at least where we were at that time. And because things were closing down, they closed down the hospital after I'd been there for about 3 months. And then we went on this R&R, which meant we could go, we went to Garmisch, we went to Switzerland skiing, and then they opened another, I mean, I was sent up to another hospital, and not very far away. And I was there a week, and they closed that down. Yeah. So one of the things, let's see, shall I look at these questions?
Sure, okay. Go ahead.
Well, I told you about the trip to Holland then, right? Where we, and I
yes.
went to Nuremberg. That was another thing I was able to do, go to the Nuremberg trials.
Okay.
And I went by myself, and that was very interesting. I remember thinking while I was sitting there, there were just American officers and Germans, of course, and then there were some other internationals that had, like Polish and other people like that, who were testifying against the group, the large group that they had there in Nuremberg. And the trial, I thought, was really sort of unfair because the conquerors were trying the conquered, and that didn't seem very, I thought they should have had countries like India and maybe and Thailand and Cuba or some other countries run making these decisions as judges rather than the Americans judging them. But of course, we were trying to, it was a military thing, and we were trying to have them to come to terms with what to do with Goering and Goebbels and all of these men who'd been so horrendous to the people who were testifying. The people who were testifying just, oh, I mean, they talked about how they made lampshades out of people and, oh, all the horrible stuff that they went through. I mean, it's just unbelievable how anybody survived those camps. And these people were testifying against them. And, you know, the men would sit there, like, I can remember seeing Goering. He didn't even have his, you know, he didn't have his earphones on. He wasn't even paying attention. 'Cause day after day, they were getting this kind of testimony.
What do you mean, earphones?
Well, they had earphones because it was translated for them. If these people were speaking in Polish, they would be translated into German. Or people were speaking English, it would be translated, so that they keep their own earphones on, they could get it in translation.
Mm-hmm.
And the same with the Americans. I mean, everybody had earphones if they wanted to use them. But,
so you're saying he wasn't even paying attention?
No, there a number of them weren't. Hess, Hess was the one who escaped to England somehow and got caught, but he was. He was very disinterested, totally disinterested in his defense. And actually, they were some. I mean, he was a little bit better off than some of the others. I remember the Donitz, I think it was, Doenitz, who was the head admiral or head of the Navy, anyway, German Navy, he had the lightest sentence. Evidently, he wasn't like as bad as the rest of some of them.
What was his sentence?
Yeah, and that's what I don't remember how long it was. I mean, maybe something like, it was like 10 years in prison or 20 years in prison, where the rest of them had life or execution or, you know, no questions. No question but what they deserved it, I guess. if you believe in capital punishment, you know. So that was interesting. And
how many days did you go?
I just went one day. Yeah, I drove down and went in for one day. So when I was being transferred a little too often, I thought, and I just didn't want to. Did I tell you about the? Did I tell you about the time I went with the officer? I think I did, and he interpreted, and the boy came out crying. Because that was an important moment when for my to making a decision to leave.
Okay.
I was driving to Frankfurt by myself in this Jeep from, where is that town, city, I've forgotten. Anyway, it wasn't Karlsruhe, it was the next place where I was stationed. It begins with O, I'll remember. Anyway, and the highways, you know, were the super highways, the beautiful highways, were places that they used for landing strips. And you would drive along and you'd see an area in the woods just right beside the road where there'd be a plane. Mm-hmm. They parked them there and they sort of hid them in under the trees. Mm-hmm. They're all parked along the Autobahn, they called it. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't any traffic much on the Autobahn because the Germans couldn't drive. They had no cars. They weren't allowed to drive. Didn't have gas. Mm-hmm. And there was just American vehicles, pretty much, and once in a while, a truckload of displaced persons. Mm-hmm. They'd be standing up in the back of a truck, mm-hmm. being shipped to a place where they could maybe eventually get home. Mm-hmm. And, there wasn't any bus or anything, it was a truck. But that's all that was on the highway. I was driving along and an airplane flew right down in front of me. I told you that. Okay. Well, this time I was driving along and I saw this American officer standing beside the Autobahn. And he motioned me to stop. Well, of course, you never let anybody stand there. Why was he there? I couldn't believe he was there. Mm-hmm. And he came over and he said he didn't have his car, it broke down, and he had to get back to Frankfurt, and he wondered if he could ride with me, of course. Mm-hmm. So I said, you drive. And he got in and he drove, and I found out he was an interpreter for the American forces, which was very interesting. He was talking about his job and how interesting it was. And I thought, wow, that's really a powerful job. It's so important. Just imagine interpreting. You'd have to say just what they meant. And I thought that was really an incredible job. So, and something to be very proud of. Well, he said, do you mind if I stop? I had one more little village to stop in, and would you mind if we went out of the way? And I did that. Mm-hmm. And I said, no, of course not, go ahead. So we drove in off the Autobahn and into this little village. And it was dusk, and the lights of the car were just sort of beginning to be necessary. I think they were on, as I recall. And suddenly, this is a little dirt road that we were going up between rows of houses, and suddenly a woman came running out of the house, crying and waving us down and waving her apron and trying to attract our attention. And he stopped, and he said, well, excuse me, I'll see if I can find out what this is all about. And I was so glad he was there, of course. And I wouldn't have been there, but it was good to have him there, and I was interested in what was going to happen. He went over to talk to her, and then out from the house came this young GI brandishing a gun and swearing like everything. I mean, he was really swearing. And you know, even then, I didn't know. I was pretty naive. I mean, I'd never heard some of the stuff that he was saying. But he came over towards the officer and the Jeep, and he saw me, and he stopped, and he just threw down his hands on the hood of the Jeep, and he started to cry. And he said, "Oh, if I'd known there was an American girl in this, I never would have said what I said." You know, I mean, it was so pathetic and sort of heartrending. He was drunk, of course, but he had sense enough to know that what he'd said wasn't appropriate for anybody, but the Germans wouldn't know what he was saying, but for me. And that's the way we were treated. You know, we were just treated with kid gloves like that all the time we were over there. And I've got a letter in here from my dear friend who was a year older than I, who went into the Red Cross a year ahead of me, and she went to the Pacific area. And she's writing me, encouraging me to come in the Red Cross, hoping I get in, this is when I was just, I told her, I guess, that I was getting in, applying anyway. And she wanted me to come to the Pacific, of course. And then she tells a lot about the Red Cross over there and what it's like to get in and how you're treated and what it's like to be a woman in the Red Cross and so on from her point of view. It's very interesting. I think that would be good if we can get that. So that's the way we were treated. Well, I was thinking, what am I doing here? You know, all I'm doing really is reminding them of home, of their girlfriends or their wives or their whatever, their girlfriends or their wives. And, you know, I'm not doing any work because I'm not really doing work because we keep getting shut down and it's hard to get going again. And I think I really should see if I could go home and get into the American Youth Hostel movement, get on the staff there and start seeing if we couldn't do something about bringing Americans over to Europe and to Germany and so on. I'd love that. I mean, as I say, that was our Peace Corps thing. Mm-hmm. And I was really eager to get into the professional end of youth hosteling. So I asked to get out, and they said yes, I could go. So I was really only in the Red Cross a year. You're supposed to sign up for 2 years, but I was only there a year. And then I went home, and I got a job as the American Youth Hostel travel director. The headquarters was at Northfield, Mass.
Okay.
And I'll just quickly tell you what we did that's related to this. My job was to organize young people to go to Europe the next year to rebuild bombed youth hostels. Mm-hmm. And so we were the only group that was allowed to go the next year because Europe was in such a mess, you know, the bombed buildings all over the place and no food and so on. Still, I mean, we were trying to recover from a terrible war and lots of total devastation in cities. And so we were allowed to go. We took 110 people, college-age kids, mm-hmm. and we had, the only reason we were allowed to go is we could take our own transportation. We had to take our bikes, mm-hmm. and we could take our own food. And my job was to select the food, that we figure out how much food we'd need for a summer. Well, it was for six weeks. And I had to figure out how much 100 people would eat and what we could carry, like dried beans and cereal and the things that you could carry on your bike that wouldn't spoil, and
So did you
raisins and
go
nuts
over
and
too?
yeah. And I went too,
Okay.
and we repaired a youth hostel in the Pyrenees that was being lived in by orphans. And we repaired the youth hostel that was the Duchess of Luxembourg had in the Luxembourg castle. We repaired that. The German officers had made a big mess of that, and she wanted that. And then we repaired one in was it Bergen op Zoom? Yeah, Bergen op Zoom, Holland. And had been flooded. They bombed the dikes, and it had been flooded, and so that was a big mess. And what we did was we divided the group into teams of 20. There were three teams, and they biked around. And so each one of them had 2 weeks, to or close to 2 weeks, to be. They would go on the train too, if necessary. 2 weeks to work. And one of the most interesting jobs, as it turned out, the most educational, was to work in that orphanage. Because we took chocolate and nuts and cheese and other things like that, apricots, dried fruit, and so on. And the woman in charge of this orphanage took all the food. And we ate what those children ate. We sat with them in long benches, and they had cabbage and potatoes, and that's what our team ate. And at every place, she would put maybe a few raisins and a little piece of chocolate and an apricot, so that the children all got some of our food too, for which we were very, very grateful. And as a matter of fact, though, it after 2 weeks, they were our team was really knew what it was like to be hungry, because they were used to so much more, yeah. So well, anyway, that's diverting here. What was my career? Well, it was I was a travel director and of American Youth Hostels, and
How many years?
how many years was I? Actually, a couple of years, and then I got married. Yeah. But I was very active, and I didn't have any veterans benefits or anything, because the Red Cross didn't get benefits like that. I mean, we really were civilians. Yeah. And said, do I make any friendships? The other friendships I made were they're especially interesting, were the French family, the Guillenots. That I think, did I tell you about them when I was in Paris?
No, you
Oh,
didn't
I
tell me.
didn't. Well, when I was first in Paris, that from Le Havre we went to Paris on a train. We were stationed in Paris in a beautiful villa, it was. And but we had a week in Paris to get acclimated and to get oriented and so forth. And there was time. And I wanted to see a French youth hostel in the worst way, and I wanted to meet some youth hostlers. And so I went out on the street and watched people biking by, and I saw this girl with this big billowy skirt just biking along. And I hailed her down. And of course, I was in uniform, so, and I tried it in my best French to ask her for the auberge de jeunesse, And she said, "Oh, you mean the youth hostel?" Perfect English. And she said, "Well, you don't want to go there. That's for poor people." She said, "In fact, I would love to have you come to my house." And she explained that she had an American GI friend who was from Texas, and he must have helped her a lot. And he'd left now, and she'd love to have me come, and she knew her parents would like to have me come to visit them and so forth. Well, anyway, so I got invited for supper while I was there in Paris. And I went, and I met her very handsome young brother who was in De Gaulle's, what did they call it? De Gaulle's private secret, well, this was, yeah, he was underground,
okay,
because De Gaulle was, you know, captured, so to speak. I mean, he was out of the picture completely. The war in France, I mean, France had been conquered, and he was the general, conquered general.
Mm-hmm.
But he had an underground,
mm-hmm,
people who were working for him, and Danny was in that.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a ski trooper, and, he was a lot of fun, and so... I saw them a number of times, and they had invited me to their home, as I said, for supper, and of course I took my rations again, and the father went down in the basement, and he had a hidden wine cellar because the Germans were taking all of his wine. He was evidently, they were a rather wealthy family. He was the head of a bicycle factory. And but they had been really persecuted, you know, and he lived in a nice little house, but they didn't have anything much. And he brought up this bottle of wine, and that was, I mean, really old. And then we had a lovely dinner, and I felt so badly about the dinner because I didn't think I should be eating, you know, there. But they had saved and saved so that they could have me for this dinner. I mean, it wasn't the first, I'd been there about 4 or 5 days and before they invited me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I remember taking them some Coca-Cola. They thought that was terrible.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. Well, if you're used to drinking wine, I guess, you know, it's Coca-Cola doesn't
comparison.
Substitute, right. And Lillian, I discovered, was a very young and successful dress designer, and she invited me to a showing, a French modeling of dresses, an evening, and then her dresses that she designed and other designers in her shop. And that was pretty exciting. And let's see, what else could I tell you about them? Well, anyway, they became great friends. The youngest daughter, her young sister, came over to the United States, came to study in Illinois, and came to see us a lot, and lived in our home. Let's see, looking back, I wasn't in any veterans organizations, and really, sadly, I didn't keep in touch with my Red Cross friends. I don't know how they'd escape, but I got so busy in youth hostling, and then, you know, I don't know how I escaped keeping in touch with them, but I lost track of them. How do you feel about my military and war experience as well? I was very glad that I had a chance to go. It was very revealing and sometimes shocking, but enlightening too. And I really didn't know what I was getting into, you know. I mean, I think we Americans, before we went to war, we were pretty naive compared. I mean, the French had been already through it, you know, World War I, and that wasn't so long ago. Their parents, Lillian's parents, or Lillian's grandparents had been in World War I. So, it has caused me to realize how fortunate we have been here in the United States. But I can say I'm not sure that it's our doing. It's just our location. Because I really feel that we haven't learned how to solve our problems without fighting. And then the fact that we're in it again now is a testimony to that. You know, when I was very active in youth hostling, I mean, we thought that was going to be, we thought that last war was the war to, World War I was the war to end wars. World War II was the war to end wars. And nothing has ended. Mm-hmm. And it is really sad, and I keep thinking, when are we going to learn to sit down and talk out our problems or be willing to share if the... You know, I really think that if we had, the Marshall Plan was the greatest thing that ever happened. That was a vision of genius, I think, because Marshall's plan fed the Germans and the Japanese, mm-hmm. and did exactly what World War I didn't do, which caused the Hitler. Mm-hmm. I mean, terrorists come because they're deprived, or something's happened in their life, or to their family, or some reason, they want to strike out, and they don't know how to do it in any other way. I mean, there's just no way. We've got to learn to share, like we did with the Marshall Plan. Countries that don't have as much as we do, and of course now, I mean, we're going to be. People are going to need to share with us. It almost looks that way. I mean, China and India are growing fast, and there are, I don't know, Europe has revived and is coming along, and we are just putting ourselves in a terrible position, I think, by continuing to fight without trying to settle and share. Well, now I don't know as we have anything to share. let's see, what else did I want to say? Well, that's it, I guess. Well, yeah, the more you kill, the more hate you engender. I mean, killing is not going to solve the problem. I mean, the Germans hated us, and I guess they hated us after World War I enough to do what they did again to make a World War II. You know, I remember here, I mean, Hitler, the children were starving. Richard Sherman's children were starving. That's why he started youth hostling. That was the best thing to do, and Hitler was doing the worst thing. Yeah. I think I've about exhausted the possibilities.